We are at Harrah's and Harvey's in Lake Tahoe. We're discussing the neural information processing systems operation and its future. And we're with John Platt. You've been a general chair of this operation before, but you're also at Microsoft Research, right?
That's right.
So I was intrigued by this statement of your research interest on your homepage. My research is focused on helping people become more effective and efficient.
Mm-hmm.
Wow. That's a large claim. How do you do it?
Oh, well, there's so many different ways where people are overwhelmed by data. And how can we, you know, and in fact, Microsoft's a great place to sort of help make tools that help people make data more presentable or effective or trying to make decisions from data. So there's lots of different ways. I mean, do you want me to go into specifics?
Yeah.
One project I worked on a bunch of years ago, for example, was a spam detector, sort of one of the first spam detectors that was made. And so instead of having to wade through a bunch of email that you don't want, can you build a thing which sorts email for you into mail that is probably for you or just sort of generic advertisements that you're just not interested in? And so that's a way of being more effective or efficient because you know, you don't have to wade through, in fact, it's much less annoying, you don't have to wade through a bunch of spam email. Or there might be tools for sophisticated users like we've done systems where we're trying to figure out the root cause of problems on computers, and you can sort of find anomalous data inside of your computer that's been stored that might be breaking an application, and we could try to find that anomalous piece of information by comparing it to many other computers. So it's another way of saying, instead of saying, why is this application broken, it'll help you find it very quickly so you don't have to waste a lot of time doing a bunch of odd things to your computer.
Right, so speak about the relationship between that and neural and NIPS.
Yeah. I mean, so a lot of the...
How do they map onto each other?
Sure. So for me, this helping people become more effective and efficient is the scenario. The tools and methods are very NIPSological. So they're sort of the same mathematical tools that we've been developing over the last 25 years. So a lot of times what we do at Microsoft Research is we have some interesting problem because Microsoft has this vast surface area because we do so many different things, and so there's lots of interesting problems trying to help people. And then in the machine learning department, which I'm in, we sit down and we say, is there something known in sort of NIPS world that we could map here? Or more interestingly, because we're in the research group, this is an interesting new kind of problem. Does it feed back to an interesting new mathematical model? It's a new sort of scenario, not just what we call classification or regression. I can explain those. Those are sort of standard methods that you would use. But is there something sort of new or more challenging? Is the data scale more challenging? Something like that, or the new kind of problems that we can extract from helping people to bring back to sort of make more mathematical models.
Before that, you were at a company called Synaptics.
That's right.
Could you explain what that was about as well?
Oh, sure. So Synaptics was founded back in the 80s by Carver Mead, who was from Caltech, and Federico Fajin, who made the first microprocessor. And again, in the 80s, there was tremendous excitement about neural computing as a whole new infrastructure of computing, just a whole new way of doing computation. And so that the company was founded to try to explore that. Where, as many startups do, you sort of are trying to seek a local maximum of sort of helping people and sort of finding potential profit. What Synaptics ended up deciding to do in 1993, or make all the touchpads in notebook computers. They make about 75% of the touchpads. So, and that's actually an interesting sensor problem because you have a lot of sort of extraneous signal, and you're trying to find the sort of the capacitive signal of a finger on this touchpad in all this extraneous noise. So that was quite successful. But what happened to me around 1997, in fact, Stork wrote this book about HAL's birthday. Remember, the HAL 9000 was supposed to have its birthday in 1997? Then I realized that, hey, wait, you know, considering the dreams of artificial intelligence in the 60s, if you look at Stork's book, it was how sort of far we were still away from the dreams. And then, so that caused me to question, well, is the dream of sort of autonomous artificial intelligence really the right dream? And then I decided, no, really the right thing to do is to use machine learning and use statistics and use AI to help people become better. And that's sort of been my guiding principle since then.
So, let me throw you a curve here. I mean, suppose we looked at Ray Kurzweil's book, The Singularity.
Mm-hmm.
That sounds to be the antithesis of what you want to happen.
Well, I think Ray Kurzweil argues, well, several ways to answer that.
I'm playing devil's advocate.
No, I understand.
Devil's advocate.
No, I understand. Well, what he's arguing is that these exponentials of computation power and effectiveness just keep going up and up and up. In fact, they keep accelerating until they reach a vertical asymptote, which is the singularity.
Yeah.
And he argues that even if we try to help people through things like, I guess, he and Werner Vinge, I think, coined the term intelligence amplification, which I sort of resonate with, that it would make this vertical asymptote. I'm not sure, because sort of nature abhors an exponential. You know, a lot of things eventually look like a logistic curve and eventually settle out. So I don't know whether we're going to have a singularity. So it's not quite what Ray is arguing is that people like me trying to essentially make intelligence amplification, IA, will help make the singularity. I don't know, because it's so hard to predict the future. I'm just trying to help people, and I'm going to try to help people over the next few years, and I don't believe it'll make some sort of disastrous vertical asymptote in society.
Yeah.
Because it's a very tough problem.
Well, I mean, but you have to have some sort of a philosophical position on this. And I'm thinking about Carver now.
Mm-hmm.
You know, I did a PBS series many years ago, and we spent a lot of time together.
Mm-hmm.
And he was always extraordinarily thoughtful in a kind of almost Zen-like fashion,
mm-hmm.
about the implications and of the applications.
Mm-hmm.
Do you think about these things? I mean,
Well, one thing I do, I think it's self-contained. I try to help people, right? I don't work on applications personally that, you know, hurt people or try to kill people or
right.
things like that. So I'm certainly not going to spend any of my energy. I'm going to try to spend all my energy trying to find positive applications that help people in society, because that's what I'm most excited by. You know, I would hope that other people don't misuse or do destructive things. I can't, of course, stop them, but I'm going to spend zero energy on destructive applications.
How did you get into this entire field to begin with? I mean, go back to 4, 5, 6 years old. I mean, were your parents scientists? Was there a teacher that impelled you? Was there a book you read? How did you get into this?
How did I get into this? So, I went to undergraduate when I was 14,
yeah.
And so I was ready to go to graduate school when I was 18. And a good friend of mine, Brett Halley, who was subsequently later on the director of operation OS development at Apple. He was telling me, this was 1982 when I was graduating, he said, you know, there's this neural stuff that's happening at Caltech. And I said, oh, that sounds very interesting, because I'd always liked science fiction as a kid, and I've, you know, always liked, you know, AI and all that concept. But I didn't know that there were sort of, I always thought it was sort of a science fictional thing. I didn't know there were sort of, you know, real people working on it. So then I applied to go to Caltech, and Carver was there, and John Hopfield, and Feynman. Feynman was there too. And they were sort of a troika of people around that era in 1982 who were very, very excited about sort of the future of computation. They all had different approaches, and you can almost think they were almost orthogonal approaches, but they were all sort of unified by the sort of the exciting potential of computation, not just sort of pure logic and pure programming, but sort of something that was sort of softer and more flexible. So as soon as I found out about that, I really wanted to go to Caltech and work on it. So that's sort of how it happened.
I think I mentioned to you last night that I actually made a program at one point about information, mm-hmm. inside information, it was called, and we had John Hopfield with a bunch of his students.
Mm-hmm.
holding up placards with different letters on them, trying to make a hot field net. Mm-hmm. It was on the lawn at Caltech. It was very funny. So Caltech was at that point. I mean, still is, but I mean, at that point, certainly was the place to be, wasn't it?
It was the epicenter. Well, it was one of the epicenters, but
MIT would be another one. But
right, that was even in the. There was the AI
lab. That was
lab.
Earlier.
There was the AI lab in the 70s, and there was a lot of work in the 80s. There was. I remember, but in terms of sort of the neural net stuff, there was UCSD. And there was Caltech. In fact, I remember a bunch of us piling into a car to drive down to San Diego, maybe in 83, just to kind of have two lab come together. So those were the two main epicenters. So Caltech was definitely a hot spot in the 80s, and that's sort of where NIPS was born.
Tell me about this whole idea, because NIPS, the first official NIPS meeting was 1987.
That's right.
But if you look at the literature, it's quite clear that there were some events organized by Ed Posner.
That's right.
In 84 through 86 that were called Hopfests, John Hopfield Fests, as it were.
Right.
Do you have any memory of those?
Oh, absolutely, because I remember giving a chalk talk. In fact, I think the whole thing was just a chalk talk that we all gathered in a lecture room in the EE building of Caltech. And it was just all tremendous excitement in 1984. Like, I'm really excited by this. And you'd draw on the chalkboard sort of what you were thinking about or what
right.
you were in the process of building. And, you know, perhaps from hindsight, you could think, oh, everything was horribly confused. I mean, if you go back and you look at the papers, there wasn't an overwhelming paradigm in the sort of Kuhn Popper, definition. But on the other hand, it was tremendously exciting because everyone had this very, very strong hope about the future. So no one knew what it was. No one even knew what the problem was. So it was sort of like groping in the dark. But it was tremendously exciting. And because we were all trying to figure out what the problem was, that's why these meetings were very exciting. And so they started out as Hopfest. It wasn't like a Festschrift. It was, I guess, I just sort of named it after John Hopfield. And then it got just so exciting, I think people drove to come in. And then we decided to have an official workshop in Snowbird, which is continuing on. It started in 86. And that was by invitation only.
There was also this conference in 1985 called Neural Networks for Computing, held in Santa Barbara.
Oh, Santa Barbara. And that was really great. In fact, that was probably the first conference I ever went to. No, I went to SIGGRAPH before that. But it was tremendously exciting because all these we met all the people who you read the papers on. It was the first sort of gathering of the people who were sort of excited by, you know, future of computation and neural networks and things. So it was a tremendously exciting meeting. And, many governmental officials thought this was sort of the future. And so you saw a lot of people from, you know, DARPA or the Army and sort of showed up.
Interestingly enough, the preface to the 1988 NIPS mm-hmm. meeting here, this is written by David Turetsky, mm-hmm. Says the briefest glance at the subject index in the back of the book should suffice to convince anyone that neural networks is not italicized, a coherent field. It is a turbulent confluence of ideas and technologies with many exciting and unpredictable developments ahead. As the old Chinese saying goes, we live in interesting times. Mm-hmm. That's still the case? Or is it becoming more coherent, do you think?
Well, it's sort of both, if I can weasel out of your question. I think what
Chinese answer.
I think, in 1987, there was, in fact, I was sort of inspired by, there was a paper by Lapides and Farber. Like, what are we doing? As I said, it was a pre-paradigm. I think the paradigm kind of crystallized about the time David Turetsky wrote that, and it was like statistics. Ah, this is about data, this is about statistics, this is about sort of algorithms and optimization. And so I think that unifies the NIPS community. It's not like it's 1,500 people who have nothing in common, because then they would just not show up. So I think it's 1,500 people who believe that statistics, you know, mathematical methods, algorithms, a common core set of sort of methods and, if I can dare use the word methodology, sort of ways of figuring out how to generate new methods, are applicable to many, many, many different fields. And they might come from specific subfields like speech or vision or natural language processing or you know, engineering software development. And they might all come together and they're all excited about learning about the latest methods. And they'll take them back home to their field. So there's a bunch of divergence in terms of which methods people like and what their applications are. And there's a lot of froth at that level. But then there's a sort of, I think, a unifying belief in sort of the power of statistics and the power of
math. I'm thinking how recent all of this really is. I mean, next year, 2012, if you say the first NIPS official meeting was 1987, let's take that. So 25-year anniversary, right? But in 1986, it says here, the Snowbird meeting, that was the one you were talking about earlier, was the only neural network conference. And it clearly could not accommodate the exploding number of research becoming. It's so recent, isn't it?
It's true. I remember, I guess it depends on maybe as a function of human history. Yes, I remember, I think a turning point, another turning point was 1991, because something happened, I'm not entirely sure what, before 1991, when you talked to people in industry and you said, oh, I do neural networks. Oh, that's all crazy stuff. Don't even talk to me. And then somehow something flipped. Just even in engineering practice, that it was okay to do statistical things. And so 1991 may have been another sort of turning point, at least that I perceived in industrial things. But you're right, it's only 20 years ago. As a function of sort of, even as in terms of modern engineering, that's relatively recent. I think it's because of computing power.
Yeah, and one of the driving forces, one of the driving engines of this, of course, was Ed Posner, who was at JPL. Interestingly enough, it was amusing to me to read that in the early 60s, 61, that Ed was hired by Sol Galam, who's obviously Terry Sinofsky's father-in-law. So there's this tightly knit community of mathematicians as well, who underpin and support this whole thing, right? But in terms of mathematicians and algorithms and NIPS, do you have a sense that the organization itself is growing larger than just being merely, I don't mean merely, purely mathematical, and there's more behavioral stuff coming into there or not? I mean, what's your sense of that?
Well, I think it's sort of like math and X. Right? I mean, there's always been a strong cognitive science component in NIPS. And so if you look at Josh Tenenbaum's work, he'll take these same methods and methodologies,
Bayesian stuff,
and apply them to try to make models of people and minds. So I think it's not that it's growing beyond math. It's like it's always had this math undercurrent, but it's always been applied math, that it's been sort of math reaching out towards applications and applications reaching out towards math. And that's been very true for many years. I mean, the math has changed and some of the applications have changed, but that's, it's always been sort of at the applied math boundary.
Yeah. So you work at Microsoft Research. What's your sense of where digital culture is actually going in this era? Actually, I hate to say this, but somebody uses the phrase in the era AG after Google. So, but I suppose there's some competitiveness.
Yes,
there.
Yes.
Just a little.
A little.
I mean, here's a question I keep getting asked: is the internet dumbing us down?
Right. So here's the question. Well, one analogy: the reason why people think that the internet is do automobiles make us weaker? Well, yes, everyone used, well, maybe but with horses they allowed it, but yes, many people walked for many miles before automobiles.
Yeah.
If you count the person plus the automobile, now we're stronger. If you count the person alone, maybe people aren't as physically fit, or maybe they can't walk as far unless they go hiking. So the question is, how do you define your system? Do you mean us, the people, or us, the people plus our technology? And so I can answer the question either way. Certainly I call my Windows phone my external brain, my exocortex. So actually, I forget who coined that term, because it reminds me of where I'm supposed to go. So I don't bother to even remember, like, oh, I'm supposed to meet with, you know, Joe on Tuesday. And that's probably good. I can offload that and not have to worry about that and try to worry about more important things. So does that make me remember things less? Perhaps. I don't know if my memory has been impaired, but does it free me up to do sort of more creative things? Yes. So the combination of me and my phone is better than me alone. So and because my phone is always there, then it's a win. So the internet's the same thing. I think any tools like that, like do hammers make you weaker? Well, maybe jackhammers or something, like, you know, people used to.
Right.
I've already made the point, so yeah.
Yeah, no. So the question I ask a lot of people, which you've already heard me raise, is the place of science in society. You know, my administration will restore science to its rightful place. What is the, in your view, what's the rightful place of science in society?
Well, that's an interesting question. So a lot of, you can view a lot of, there's science and there's sort of almost like decision making. And you would like to have decision making be unbiased and dispassionate and be the most informed as possible. Science is definitely a process. The process of science is a great way to collectively reach unbiased, well-informed decisions. So, of course, I mean, there's a whole process. I mean, what Obama was referring to is that there's this governmental process of creating regulations, and it's a very complex process that might have perverse disincentives. And so the question is, how can we adapt this unbiased process of science towards helping the sort of decision-making of government? And I know that Obama has this this cabinet of scientists called PCAST, and that seems to be an effective way of injecting sort of dispassionate scientific information at the highest level.
This is John Holder and Eric, Lander, mm-hmm. and so on and so mm-hmm. forth, yeah.
And Craig Mundy.
But, you know, good scientists.
Mm-hmm.
See, what I'm thinking about is if you look back to the 50s, mm-hmm. the area of James Conant or Vannevar Bush, mm-hmm. I mean, they wielded immense power. I mean, they were sending reports back to the president at the time, mm-hmm. which led to the National Science Board, National mm-hmm. Science Foundation. Huge, huge impact at that point.
Well, physics won World War II, right?
Right.
So that was sort of, it's interesting. The 50s seem to be, I wasn't around in the 50s, but they do seem to be this interesting decade of sort of the apogee of sort of technocracy, precisely because they were sort of coming off this giant success, right? But that, my interpretation is it faded out over the decades only because it receded in the past. And also there were, you know, problems caused by technology that were clear, and there was a bit of a anti-technology backlash in the 60s. So I don't know. I still think it relates actually back to NIPS because, you know, I was mentioning that, you know, you can have scientists doing science, and then there's this sort of extra process of decision making. And one of the things that I'm sort of excited by, and other people at NIPS are excited by, are tools for making more effective decision making, right? To provide the information, the right information to you at the right time. So it's sort of like you could do as much science as you like, but if it's isolated from decision making, and it always will be because there'll be different sort of talents of people doing science and talents of people making policy, but it's really interesting to try to make tools for decision support. And that's been a long-term, you know, dream of both NIPS and other fields, things like the UAI conference, or there's just a whole field in terms of decision support. So it's an interesting scientific problem to actually bridge this gap between data and decision. So that's one of the things I actually like.
Yeah. So having gone through your trajectory at this point, you get young people coming into Microsoft Research, into your department. Young scientists. Many years ago, Sir Peter Medawar wrote a book called Advice to a Young Scientist. Mm-hmm. And then there was, of course, the Advice to a Young Investigator as well. But what advice do you give to young folks who are in the business, just starting out?
Well, of course, we interact a lot with grad students who are to come to Microsoft Research's internships, and then I interact a lot with the young researchers in Microsoft Research who are, industrial researchers. Right. So what I tell people is think big. Try, even early in your life, try to think about legacy. Try to think about what a lot of, people who are 25 don't really naturally think about this. But what do you want to be known for in 5, 10, 15, 20 years? What is the big impact you want to make on society? Reason backwards. Don't just say, oh, here's a little bit of math that I really like. But instead think, okay, you can do anything you want. Microsoft researchers have a lot of freedom. What's the big thing? How are you going to change society? What are you going to do to make things better? And so I really encourage everyone to sort of think along those lines of what's the biggest positive impact they can make in their world, and then reason backwards from that. So
it's a real visionary perspective then.
I guess I encourage everyone to be. I don't think you should have, I think it's a poor structure to have, one or two or three gray-haired visionaries and everyone sort of, listening to them. I think it's everyone should try to be a visionary. Everyone should try to think of what do they want the future to be, and then find people with shared vision and get together and do something great.
Yeah. Would you have ever liked to have run a company? I mean, is that the thing you, could you be Bill?
Oh, I can't. Well, Bill has amazing talents. I certainly. Business is different from science. And you don't just because you're good at one doesn't mean you're necessarily good at the other.
Yeah. But you've been talking about the importance of decision making, mm-hmm. and understanding how decisions are made well, mm-hmm. which in theory ought to be the sign of a good businessman, right?
That's true. But they also have to get.
So if you understood that, then should you not be able to craft yourself into the great decision maker?
I suppose so. There's also a certain amount of. It's hard being an executive. There's a lot of it has to do with interpersonal relationships and relationships between the people in a society, and so it's tough. I mean, the more people who you manage, the more knotty problems you get in terms of trying to get this group of people to work with that group of people,
But that's my point. You can understand decision making as a cognitive process, mm-hmm. but then when you have to put it into society, a group of people, and so on, mm-hmm. all the edges get blurred.
Mm-hmm.
So it's kind of a trade-off, isn't it?
Well, you do the best you can, right? I mean, you try to help people make the best decisions they can, but we're not going to make the. This is why I don't think. Well, autonomous AI is sort of this ever-receding dream because it is all real problems are incredibly multifaceted, and so that's why I want to make tools to help people. I don't want to make tools to replace the people making the decisions because it's just it's almost impossible. I mean maybe. Sometime in the far future, but it's...
Do you read widely in science, in history of science, philosophy of science?
Some, I don't know. I mean, I don't know if I claim to read widely, but I've done some.
Is there some other thing that you could have wanted to have done if you'd been... Are you a frustrated opera singer or something? I mean, is there something else you'd have liked to have done, or was it always going to be science?
No, I think ever since I was a kid, it was always some flavor. I mean, I sort of changed my mind about the flavor of science over as I grew up, but, through childhood, but... Yeah, I'm not a frustrated opera singer.
If I gave you a time travel token and said you could bring to your dinner table anybody from any period of history, any discipline, whatever, somebody that you just would love to sit down, have a conversation with, mm-hmm. and ask questions of, mm-hmm. does somebody spring to mind?
Yeah, I think... this might be a horrible cliche, but Albert Einstein.
Right.
And I would say not Albert Einstein necessarily of the IAS sort of more elder years, but maybe, it might be interesting to talk to him, right when he was doing, 1905, or maybe 1910, right when he was sort of formulating the theory of relativity. Because Einstein was really interesting that he was... now the cliche is out of the box. Physics was really suffering, and it was breaking under its own contradictions. And a lot of what he did was it was sort of very creative and very elegant and very simple. And so I would have loved to talk to him to see if I could learn, did it just well up from inside? I mean, was it a thing that he could sort of self-examine and explain and say, oh, no, what I was really thinking about was this? Or right. Anyway, so I think that would be really interesting.
Did you read Alan Lightman's novel, Einstein's Dreams?
No.
Oh, that's well worth looking at, because it kind of gets a little bit inside that feeling you're talking about.
Mm-hmm.
Alan, of course, was a physicist himself, so. Mm-hmm. Last question. Mm-hmm. What are you optimistic about?
What am I optimistic about? I guess it depends on to what baseline, but I'm actually optimistic about, over the longer term, trying to solve general intelligence. Because now I think we have enough data about, you know, all connected through the world, through the internet. We have enough computational power. We're starting to learn how to do it in parallel. Now, finally, I think sort of, you know, AI was almost launched 50 years too early. Because now, finally, we might be able to make some traction on this thing. And I'm not saying everyone at NIPS feels that way, but there's some subset of us who are optimistic about this. I don't want to overpromise. I don't want to make another AI winter or anything, but finally, we have enough data, we have enough compute, we might be able to start bashing on this problem.
Good. John Platt, nice to talk to you. Thanks very much.